I want to bring you tonight, and I'm doing this at night, but you'll probably listen to it in the daytime, the follow-up on the first podcast that I did on hydroxychloroquine, and that was back on the 8th of July, and now we're almost out of July. My guest is Brian C. Proctor, medical doctor. He's from McKinney, Texas, and he has a practice called McKinney Family Medicine. And he has some really good statistics on helping people in his clinic to stay out of the hospital and to not die. Brian, can you tell the people listening today about your educational history and your certifications?
Yes, sir, Wynn. After high school, I started off at Annapolis, the United States Naval Academy, and I wanted to fly jets like my old man did in the Marine Corps, and he was an American Airlines pilot, and so I tried to go down the pilot road, and the only other thing I ever wanted to be was a surgeon. So I went to Annapolis, kind of learned how to grow up there, what kind of man I wanted to be, and I ended up losing a lot of my vision the first year there, and I would have been disqualified as a pilot. And so the only other thing I ever wanted to be was a surgeon. Annapolis will only send 5 grads a year to Uniformed Services Military School in Bethesda, and that was a cut I didn't think I could make. There were 70 pre-meds in the class, and they'll only send 5. So I decided to leave after a year and a half. I was on the dean's list when I left, and I came home to my parents' house in Bedford, Texas, and I went to Tarrant County Junior College, and then was there for a semester. Then I went to University of Texas in Austin. I got a bachelor's degree in molecular biology. I didn't get into med school the first year. I retook the MCAT and did really well on it, got in the second year. So in that year off, I worked at a biotech company down in Houston, close to the Astrodome. And so the following year, in 1993, I got accepted to Texas Tech Medical School in Lubbock, Texas. I did my first 2 years of med school in Lubbock, did the second 2 years of med school with Texas Tech in Amarillo, graduated from there, and then I stayed there for residency in family medicine, and I finished family practice residency in 2000, June of 2000, and I immediately moved to McKinney, built a clinic, and opened it August 1st of 2000. So we are coming up on my 20th anniversary of being a board certified solo practitioner in McKinney, Texas, with running my own business, which is kind of unique these days. And I've amassed somewhere around 35,000 charts in 20 years. So that's kind of my background.
Well, that's great. So you've been doing this for a long time. You know what you're doing. You're certified by the board, and you have a practice in McKinney, Texas. Now, yes. I know that you're overworked, but if I've got somebody in my state that can't get treated, I need to have doctors in other states that I can send them to. Could you take an occasional additional patient?
Yes, sir. I think so. I mean, through word of mouth or whatever, yes, sir. Right now it's kind of tough because my phone lines are clogged up because of the letter I wrote on the internet. But sure, I'm willing to work in people.
Well, now your office phone number is 972-562-8388. And sometimes it's hard to use your voicemail and everything, but...
That's correct. I mean, since I released the letter and my information went viral online, the Well, apparently our phone system only holds 700 voicemails, and as soon as we cleaned some off, it filled back up again immediately. So it stayed pretty much full for the last month, which has been a challenge to running my practice. But we found other ways. Patients can go on our website and email us for an appointment. That's a good way to bypass the phones. So they can email me. If they go to our website at McKinneyFamilyMed.com, it's how to contact us is on there. They can request an appointment that way, and my staff would get back to them a lot quicker using that method.
And what's your email?
I think it's McKinneyFamilyMed.com.
Okay. All right. So I picked up on your video and your letter back at the first of the month. And since then, I've been trying to find other doctors who have as much experience and as high a success rate as you have. And you may know that because of this pushback on the drug that is making my life miserable, because it's hard to find people that can tell the truth and can give people hope for a cure from COVID-19, so that they have to be one of those 1,100 patients that die every day. So
sure.
Let's get into your practice. What are the diagnostic criteria that you need to be able to give a person your treatment plan?
Well, there's a lot of symptoms of COVID-19. So what I did in my methodology, which I didn't really look up anywhere, I think I saw some things early on about major symptoms, lesser symptoms, and then severe symptoms that are worrisome symptoms. So I kind of took the major symptoms and crafted kind of six questions concerning, what I call major symptoms. And those are fevers at night, cough, shortness of breath, body aches, and fatigue. And so those are six symptoms. And what I noticed is that there seemed to be a strong correlation between how many of those symptoms they have and what their statistical probability for having COVID actually is. And I kind of noticed that early on, is that the people that had all six of those symptoms, almost universally, their COVID test would be positive. So if their symptoms are less than six, then the fewer symptoms they have, the less likely it is to be COVID. So that cutoff seems to be 3 to 4 out of six or more. It's pretty suggestive of COVID. It's pretty easy right now, because when you look at those symptoms, a lot of them are flu symptoms. But in the middle of July, it's in Texas, There's not a whole lot of other things that this could be. And these patients typically also describe the onset is not as sudden as the flu is. The onset is more, it's more gradual. And it's also like a roller coaster. So there are some other characteristics of COVID that you can ask, or questions that you can ask patients with, that they'll pretty much tell you it's COVID, or you've got a pretty good idea that it's COVID. So what I do is I have the nurses ask all those questions, the lesser symptoms, the major symptoms, and the severe symptoms. And then I look at the major symptoms, and if they have three or more, then I start being extremely suspect of COVID-19. So, but if they have four or more, I pretty much call it COVID-19 at that point. So if they have a smattering, if they have three or more, or four or more, I'm sorry, and a smattering of the other lesser symptoms and severe symptoms like chest tightness and things like that, and then I usually go ahead and diagnose it as COVID. I'll order the swab as a confirmation, but I can't wait for that swab to come back. Sometimes it can take 3 to 5 days to come back. We had a week there where we had five patients that we were 2 weeks out and still waiting for the test to come back, and we can't wait 5 days or 3 days. Every day counts in this disease, and the earlier you treat it, the more successful you can be at treating it, and the higher the likelihood that you will get them well fast without without any complications.
Well, Brian, I had elective surgery at the VA last month, and they wouldn't let me have it or even come in the hospital unless I had a negative test. And so they did a negative test in the parking lot, and they had the results in a little bit under an hour.
Yes, sir.
So what's the difference between being able to get results quickly and what I hear from California and other places that it's taken up to 18 days to get a result?
Well, since I'm a little guy on the totem pole, I haven't been able to get a hold of any rapid tests. And we've been trying to get a hold of rapid tests for months. And since I'm not a major player, they don't want to send them to me. So we're trying to, we're looking into some things through McKesson, but getting a hold of rapid tests has been something that's really hard to do. But honestly, if the test, say I did have rapid tests, and say they had 4 out of 6 symptoms, and 4 out of 6 of those major symptoms, and that test comes back negative, there's a lot of false negatives. I mean, I think there's around 30% false negatives. If you look at my chart alludes to the fact that there are probably lots of false negatives. And my false negatives mean that these are patients who had a negative test, that they had all the symptoms, so we treated them anyway. And you know what? They all got better. And we didn't have any complications or horrible side effects from the medications whatsoever. After 300 patients, I haven't had any horrible side effects on anybody. I've had a couple patients who had some nausea and vomiting for a couple of days, possibly from the medicine, but it possibly could have been from COVID. But other than that, I haven't had any complications from these medicines. But anyway, so back to testing. If I get a negative test and they have all the symptoms, I'm going to treat them anyway. I can't trust that test. First of all, I didn't run the test. And I have about as much faith in those things as I do in rapid strep tests or rapid flu tests. And whether I send it off to a lab and run a PCR test on it or I'm doing a rapid test in my office, I would put the same credibility on both of those. But I'm not going to miss a COVID case with my regimen in the way I'm doing this. I'm not going to miss one. We've only had 2 instances or so where we diagnosed somebody with, say, an upper respiratory infection or a sinus infection, and they called back 2 days later, significantly worse, and then we treated them. I think that's only happened probably 2 or 3 times out of 300. But I can't put a whole lot of faith in testing. So, you know, getting behind our government's current action plan on COVID and thinking that testing is the answer, I don't believe that's true. I believe that you can do a simple clinical exam and clinical questionnaire and fairly accurately be able to tell if somebody has a high probability for active disease or not.
So let me see if I can summarize then. If they have at least 3 or possibly 4 of the 6 symptoms that you spoke about, or if they have less but they have a positive test, then you treat them with your regimen.
Correct.
Okay.
Or if they have a positive test, I would naturally treat them.
Would you say those 6 symptoms again, because people are going to want that information?
So today, a lot of people are coming in to my office and they already have a positive test in hand. Some of them have a negative test, but they've already had symptoms for two weeks and sometimes more. And if they have all the symptoms, then I treat them anyway. But a lot of the patients that come to see me come in and they already have a positive test, which I prefer because that makes things simple. But anyway, the symptoms are, again, one more time, fever, night fever, cough, shortness of breath, fatigue, and body aches.
Okay. All right. So let's go on with your statistics. You're up to 299 patients about.
Yes, sir. That's correct.
That you've treated. What is your success rate, and what is your rate of not success?
Well, out of the 299, I've had one hospitalization. And other than that, I mean, everybody else has gotten better. We have had one death, and I'm not sure at this moment if that death was COVID-related or not. So I've got to do some more investigated stuff on that. I believe that it is COVID-related, and the gentleman was 83 years old and sadly passed away a few nights ago. So that will probably show up on my board in the coming days. But the rest of them have done quite well because I've only had one hospitalization, and that particular patient is out and doing doing pretty well. We have placed 243 of the 299 patients in the total recovered category. So then there are current cases that we're actively monitoring. We're currently at 56.
Well, you know, I've been a medical doctor since 1972, and I've not had that kind of success rate with practically anything that I've done. So I applaud you on that, and I want to get this message out as far as I can spread it, that hydroxychloroquine is safe, it's effective, and it's being manipulated so that doctors aren't prescribing it, and so what happens? They go to the hospital and die. That's my major message. Treat early, treat aggressively, but don't over-treat. If there was a study that said that hydroxychloroquine doesn't work or is unsafe, it probably was because they either waited too long to start treatment or they gave too high a doses. Do you find
one study that was too high of a dosage? So they were actually using fatal dosages of hydroxychloroquine.
Now, the other thing that's got people scared is if you use the recommendation, which we're going to go into in a minute, at the dose level, what have you seen with respect to any electrocardiogram or cardiovascular problems with the drug?
So I haven't had any complications with it. So what our normal procedure is, and I would never do this ordinarily. This drug has been prescribed for 60 years or whatever, since like 1957, for numerous ailments. And I have had numerous patients, probably hundreds, who have taken hydroxychloroquine every day for decades and have never had a single problem. And it was never considered standard of care to obtain an electrocardiogram prior to treating people with hydroxychloroquine before, and I don't know why it should be now. But because of the negative media coverage on the medicine, we did decide early on to start doing EKGs before prescribing the medicine, just to make sure that their EKG is okay and that they can take the medication safely. The issue, or what we're looking for on the EKG, is an EKG finding called long QT syndrome, which is an arrhythmia or an abnormal heart rate type issue, that if they have that underlying condition of long QT syndrome, potentially if you put these patients on medications such as hydroxychloroquine, Zithromax, multiple other types of medicines, and just so incidentally on the side, marijuana also can cause this. It can make the long QT syndrome worse, and potentially these patients can go into a potentially fatal arrhythmia called torsade de pointe, which is extremely rare, and I don't know a single doctor who's ever seen this, and I've talked to two cardiologists about it. So that's what we're looking for. So what I do is I basically rule that out at the get-go. And by doing an EKG, then I prescribe the medicine if it's okay. Now, I've had about, out of those 300 patients, I've had about four or five that did have long QT syndrome or evidence of potentially long QT syndrome on their EKG, and we have opted not to treat them with hydroxychloroquine. So on those patients, I used the rest of my regimen, and all of those patients did get better. There are also a number of patients who, days after taking the hydroxychloroquine, or starting the hydroxychloroquine, we only treat them for 5 days. Days afterwards, they have developed maybe some increasing chest pain, or the chest tightness didn't go away or something like that. Since that's a symptom of COVID, it's kind of hard to tell, well, is it the hydroxychloroquine or is it the COVID that's causing this? So we'll have them come back in. We'll do another EKG and make sure that the EKG is okay. And once we know that's okay, we know it's safe to continue that hydroxychloroquine. And then we usually get more aggressive with a second-tier treatment on their COVID or something like that. Or we just send them home with reassurance and hope and tell them to continue the regimen. Hopefully they get better.
Okay, so there's a finding on the EKG that if you don't have it, you don't have to worry about that complication.
I believe that's correct. And the cardiologists I've talked to about this have also agreed. So I do have a cardiologist who's actually my personal physician. I don't have any heart problems, but I had to pick a PCP, so I picked a cardiologist. But anyway, so if I have something that was an EKG I'm kind of on the fence about, I'll take a picture of it and I'll text it to him. And within a couple of minutes, he'll text me back if I have anything to worry about or not. So that gives me extra reassurance and my patients extra reassurance that, hey, you know, there was a little glitch here maybe, but he ran it by a cardiologist. They said it's okay. So I've got two doctors that say it's okay, and so we're good to go. So that gives the patients extra reassurance that hey, I'm not going to have some horrible arrhythmia from this medicine or anything like that.
Well, there are people out there that are trying to put the fear factor into this equation so
right. That
you won't
people
want
that misuse
the drug. Okay, so we've covered that. Now, I'd like to ask you about cost. What is the average cost of coming to clinic and treatment?
I would say by the time I do an EKG and give somebody 3 injections with an office visit, if it's a new patient, in their cash pay, it's just under $400.
Okay.
In my
now you probably can't even get to the hospital for $400.
No one's getting treated in a hospital for $400 or an ER for that matter. Not for COVID.
Well, or probably
go to the ER and they're charged about $2,000 and told to go home and take Tylenol and wait to get worse, and then they'll put them in the ICU and they can die.
Right. So, as far as the medicines, the prescriptions that you write, I think you told me that they didn't have insurance for prescriptions that they could buy them for under $50. Is that right?
Yeah, yes, sir. I believe the hydroxychloroquine, as I write it, plus the azithromycin, plus the losartan, those 3 medications came out to be around $34.11 cash out of pocket at the pharmacy that I use. That is the main portion of my treatment regimen. That doesn't include the supplements, because one of my supplements is CBD, and it's very expensive. For 60 pills, it's about $90. But the main central core of my treatment regimen, they're all generic drugs, and it's $34.11. Now, Dr. Richard Bartlett came out with his budesonide findings. So we do use budesonide, which is another prescribed medicine that is an inhaled steroid that we give the patients through a nebulizer twice a day. That medicine's a little bit more expensive. If I add that one in there, I think that one's around $35 to $40 for a month's supply. And I usually dispense a month's supply because a lot of times there's some lung scarring in these patients that are having pretty bad respiratory symptoms. So I try to keep them on the breathing treatments for up to a month to help to help alleviate that scarring and that inflammation. So, and it's the budesonide does seem to help. It doesn't seem to be the end-all be-all of COVID treatment. It seems you have to use multiple modalities and multiple medications to attack this virus from all different angles to really be effective. But the main crux of my treatment regimen, just those three prescriptions, $34.11.
So when I heard that, I thought, would anybody in their right mind not pay that kind of money to have the success rate that you've had of not getting into the emergency room, hospital, respirators, and dying? I mean, that seems to be a no-brainer. But for some reason or the other, there's a tremendous pushback on hydroxychloroquine. And I don't know why it is, and perhaps you don't either, but we can suppose that it has something to do with money. And but what you're offering the people, if they get treated early at a low cost, is to take away the possibility of dying.
Or hospitalization.
Or hospitalization, which would cost tens of thousands of dollars, I would imagine.
Well, it's not just that, Wynn. There's a problem with hospitalization. See, what a lot of people don't know this, and the public really doesn't know this, hospitals are not like they were 6 months ago. Hospitals have changed. It's not the same hospital it was 6 years ago. The hospitals today, when you go in there, you walk in those doors and those doors close behind you, your family cannot go with you. So as soon as those doors close behind you, you've lost all of your autonomy. You've lost all of your advocacy because your patient, your loved ones, your family can't look after you. And you've lost a significant amount of your rights. And if you become confused, sick enough to where you're confused and you're unsure and you can't make decisions, you're putting your life at that point wholly in other people's hands who, as we saw in New York, have been motivated by financial gain because they were receiving $29,000 per patient if they could show that they had COVID. So above and beyond what they were billing insurance for X patient in New York, they were getting a $29,000 stipend free of charge on top of it that they didn't even have to fight for. So they wanted to call as many people COVID as they could, hurry up and get them on the ventilator to get that $29,000. And there are videos about that online. So a lot of that's financially motivated. So when you walk in those doors and they close behind you, that's a scary thing. I mean, that turns into a horror movie. So I've talked to patients who have gotten out of the hospital with COVID. I've had several patients that were treated in the hospital, got out of the hospital, and I saw them for the first time a few days later. And they did fine after that. But anyway, they've told me their stories, and they're scary. The patient that I had that was hospitalized, I asked him when he got out of the hospital, I said, tell me what the doctors did while they were in there. And he said they talked to him. And I said, what do you mean they talked to you? He said, well, they talked to me from the doorway, but they didn't really come in the room. And I said, wait a minute. You're telling me that you were in the hospital for 7 days and a doctor, a nurse practitioner, or a PA never touched you? He said, that's correct. I said, they never listened to your heart. That's correct. They never listened to your lungs. That's correct. They did not do any type of physical exam, hands-on physical exam whatsoever. He says, that is correct. I said, well, who did examine you? And he said, the nursing staff. So these patients are going to the hospital and doctors don't even examine them because the doctors are cowards and won't even go in the room with the patient and examine their patient. But what kind of medicine is this these days? This is not the medicine I learned in med school when we're taught to talk to our patients, examine our patients, treat our patients. So I was appalled, and he told me this, and he swore about it up and down. I couldn't believe it. I was flabbergasted. So, in other words, the story that I'm painting, if you have to go into the hospital with this thing, it is a very scary event full of extreme anxiety. That anxiety of this event and what happens to these people has led to post-traumatic stress disorder, all types of anxiety, depression, once they get out of the hospital. So the main goal isn't just to save their lives, Wynn. It's to keep them out of the hospital.
Yeah. Now, you talked about physicians' fear. I suppose that's of them contracting COVID. But my research has indicated that if you take a low dose of hydroxychloroquine, that you don't catch COVID. So here's another reason why healthcare providers ought to be taking hydroxychloroquine so they don't have to stand in the doorway.
Along with a low dose of zinc, yes, sir. And a healthy dose of vitamins.
Okay.
And I do have a immune-boosting protocol on my Facebook page and on my Twitter page of the vitamins that I recommend.
Okay. Well, let's.
So yes, I agree. I agree about hydroxychloroquine prophylaxis. I am a firm believer that there are two ways to fight this pandemic. One way is to put the whole country on hydroxychloroquine. It's safe in children. It's safe in pregnant women. It's safe in the elderly. There are very few drug-drug interactions with this medication. So, and it's extremely safe. We could prophylax the entire country with low-dose zinc and hydroxychloroquine. And I mean prophylaxis with hydroxychloroquine, I'm not talking about taking four pills a day. I'm talking about taking a pill once a week or once even every other week, because what a lot of people don't understand is the half-life of hydroxychloroquine is up to 50 days. It stays in your system for up to 50-plus days, which is a really long time, which makes it ideally suited for prophylaxis because it's cheap. You don't have to take many pills to achieve adequate prophylaxis. So a three-month supply of this thing, you know, is 12 pills, six pills. I mean, that costs nothing. And we can mass produce this easy-to-make drug on a massive scale, scale up production of this, put the entire country on prophylaxis, and most of the aggressive doctors that I know that are treating COVID believe that this would virtually eradicate the pandemic in as little as 45 days. The other way to do it is just put high-risk people and people in certain occupations like healthcare, maybe flight crews on aircraft and the airplanes, flight attendants, et cetera, put them on prophylactic hydroxychloroquine, all healthcare people, all high-risk people, all of the elderly, and then treat everybody aggressively and early within days of symptom onset, 2-3 days max, hopefully, that they can get into their doctor. The doctors will prescribe this medicine instead of just telling them to take Tylenol and get these people better fast. Because if you treat these people early and they're well in 5 days instead of 3 weeks, then there's 2+ weeks there where they're no longer contagious. You just saved maybe 8-10 people from that one index patient, could have spread it to 8 or 10 people in those 2 weeks. Under our current policy, we're just telling them to take Tylenol. And I don't know about you, Wynn, but I don't have a whole lot of my faith in my patients holding up in their bedroom for 2 weeks without moving. I mean, most people, you know, they take it with a grain of salt. They're okay for 3 or 4 days, and then they got to get out of there. They got to go do something. And then they go run around and go to the mall or shopping or this and that. And they're spreading the disease around. So the less time that these people are symptomatic means that there's less time that they're contagious, and there are less people that they're spreading this virus to. And that would make a much bigger impact than all of these people wearing masks. And now they want us to wear face shields. And the next thing they're going to want us to be is John Travolta in a bubble. And I'm not doing it. So, And I think a lot of people out there don't want to do it either.
So let me ask you a question. Is there anything our president could do with the power that he has to make this a reality?
So what the doctors that in the groups that I'm involved with, like AmericasFrontlineDoctors.com, our goal has been to get into the president's ear. And I think we were pretty successful doing that last weekend with Dr. Emmanuel, Dr. Gold, and the other colleagues that were up there in Washington on getting the message out. And our target, and a lot of people need to understand that the target was not the press. We don't really care what the fake news media press thinks. We know that they're corrupt, and we know that they're on the other side of the fence from us, and we're not trying to win them over. That wasn't the target of what we were trying to do. We were trying to plant a seed in the president's ear. And we are trying to get Dr. Harvey Risch, who's one of the world's leading virologists and epidemiologists, to have a meeting with the president to maybe go over this and try to get some change in direction, because the current direction and our current plan of attack of this is not only is it cowardly, but I mean, I think hiding behind a mask and taking Tylenol and waiting to get it, waiting to die is ridiculous. We don't treat any other diseases this way, so why should we treat this way? But anyway, if we could get someone like Dr. Risch in front of the president, maybe the president could pass an executive order that mandates prophylactic use on a voluntary basis of all high-risk people, the elderly, the healthcare employees, on a voluntary basis, of course, and mandate that in an executive order to give doctors permission to maybe go against what their current medical boards are wishing, which is that we don't use it at all. This would give doctors confidence that, hey, I can prescribe this. There's an executive order in place. Now I can be comfortable giving this to my patients. And I think we have plenty of data that supports prophylactic use of hydroxychloroquine in the treatment of COVID-19.
Well, if I am not mistaken, Harvey Risch, who is an epidemiologist, medical doctor at Yale, he got his training at Yale, he said that if this were implemented, it would save between 75,000 and 100,000 lives.
Correct, but then it goes beyond that. Imagine what that would mean to the U.S. economy. Imagine what that would mean to small business owners. Imagine what that would do to the suicide rate, the unemployment rate, the people that are really suffering. Most of the people that are really suffering from COVID are not people that contract the disease. These are small business owners and employees that have been furloughed. They have no income, or soon to have no income when the $600 a week and their unemployment runs out. It's not going to be very good. So we've got to get America back to work. We've got to get our economy back where it was 6 months ago. And this is the fastest way to do it. So currently, their way, Dr. Fauci's way, is not working. It hasn't worked in 4 months. Here we are 4 months later, and the death toll today was just as high as it's ever been. So masks are not going to reduce this down to zero. They're never going to reduce this down to zero. What we have to do is we have to be smart. We have to get out of the trenches. Hiding in the trenches is not working. We have to get out of the trench with our sword and go out there and kill the virus. And so that's what I'm trying to do, and that's what I've been doing for 4 months, and I've been pretty successful at it.
Well, let's talk about the treatment plan then. Most of the doctors that I've interviewed that actually treat COVID patients early with aggressive treatment say that there are three primary things that they need: hydroxychloroquine, azithromycin and zinc. You mm-hmm. and your plan too. And I'm going to read you what I got from your literature, because if doctors are listening to this program, they need to know actual dose schedule so that they can do it for their patients. And you tell me if I mess up. The hydroxychloroquine is 400 milligrams twice a day for one day, and then 200 milligrams twice a day for 4 days. Is that right?
Yes, sir. That's correct.
Azithromycin is 500 milligrams for one day, and then 250 milligrams per day for 9 days.
For a total of 10 days. Yes, sir.
Okay. And zinc is 200 milligrams daily for 10 days. Did I get that strength right? Or?
Yes, sir. That's correct. 200 milligrams for 10 days. Okay. After that, I usually drop them down to 50 milligrams.
Okay. Now, those are the three primary drugs. Now, let's talk about some of the other also drugs that you use. You use Losartan, which is a blood pressure drug, at 25 to 50 milligrams twice a day for 10 days. Why do you use that drug?
So there's been a lot of research done on the angiotensin receptors in the lung tissue and the heart tissue. So these angiotensin receptors are involved in the binding process of the virus, COVID-19, with the cell wall, SARS-CoV-2 with the cell wall. Once they bind to the receptor, this facilitates the entry into the virus into the cell, where it replicates, is my understanding. So these receptors that the spiky things on the virus bind to are called angiotensin receptors. Losartan is an angiotensin receptor blocker. It binds to that receptor. So if the drug is binding to the receptor, this helps prevent the virus from binding to the same receptor because it can't get in there. So by doing so, it seems that Losartan and angiotensin receptor blockers, at least in small doses, help preserve myocardial and pulmonary function.
Okay, I understand. Now, there is some talk about using steroids, and you have on your also list budesonide,
yes, sir.
That's a steroid, one vial nebulized twice a day.
Yes, sir.
And
so that was based on Dr. Richard Bartlett's work out in West Texas. Early on when we first started doing this, when I first started treating COVID in March, at the end of March, steroids were kind of considered to be taboo in the treatment of COVID. But over the months, we've gradually come to accept that they are helping the inflammatory process, which is there's an immense inflammatory process that's macrophage-mediated with this virus and releasing lots of cytokines, leading to cytokine storm, which leads to DIC, which ultimately leads to death in the hospital. But so this inflammatory process is curtailed somewhat by steroids, and I think we figured that out in time. This is based on Richard Bartlett's work with budesonide, a steroid, also with the London study that came out about a month ago, showing dexamethasone helping. And so I'm giving them budesonide to help decrease that pulmonary inflammation in the lung tissue, because a lot of the patients, even after they're well and their COVID test is, the PCR test is negative again, and they're no longer symptomatic, a lot of them still have pretty significant chest tightness, still have some shortness of breath on exertion, maybe some fatigue. And I think a lot of that is scar tissue and inflammation that just persists in the lungs. And a subset of patients seems to have that. They seem to have that for months afterwards. So I think the budesonide helps curtail the development of that complication, but also treat that complication if it develops. So in the patients who have significant respiratory symptoms on the at the beginning, I go ahead and put them on budesonide too, because it's cheap, it's relatively inexpensive. A nebulizer machine only costs about $30 at most pharmacies now, at least the pharmacy I'm using. And so for $30 and another $60, they can be on breathing treatments, even if they're cash pay. But like I said, most of my patients are insurance patients. So a lot of that's, we just bill it through insurance.
Okay, so the next drug is aspirin, 325 milligrams. That's a standard aspirin tablet, once a day for 10 days. And I assume that you do that for DIC?
Yes, sir, trying to prevent DIC and just this, the abnormalities in the clotting cascade. And one of the things that we noticed early on doing blood work is we were drawing a lab called D-dimer, which for the public out there, that's the test that we do in the emergency rooms when we're worried about blood clots in the legs or blood clots in the lungs, called pulmonary emboli, stuff like that. And so in these COVID patients, we're seeing, even in the beginning stages, we see elevations in D-dimer levels. They're pretty mild, maybe up to three times the upper limit of normal. So, but still, in those patients, that gets me worried about, you know, DIC and clotting cascade issues becoming a complication. So I try to protect them against that, to also keep them out of the hospital for those reasons, by using high-dose aspirin for 10 days, which is 325 milligrams once a day for 10 days. After that, I suggest that they step down to 81 milligrams a day.
Okay. And you also recommend B12, 1,000 micrograms daily for 10 days. Why the B12?
For some reason, I've heard reports about possible antiviral properties of B12, but we know it boosts the immune system tremendously, and a lot of these are extremely fatigued, so it definitely helps them with their fatigue level.
Okay. Vitamin D, 3.
Vitamin D is the same thing. Vitamin D helps boost immune system. It helps you think, focus, concentrate. It helps prevent depression, anxiety. There's a lot of depression, anxiety that goes along with having COVID. But it also seems to help boost the immune system and help fight the virus.
Okay, and that's 10,000 international units a day for 10 days.
Yes, sir, of vitamin D3.
Okay. And then N-acetylcysteine. What about that one?
So NAC, or N-acetylcysteine, was used as a mucolytic back in the days we were residents, and where I was a resident. We used to clean out ET tubes and trach tubes in the hospital with it, because it's a mucolytic. But NAC has a lot of immune modulator properties that help with things like seasonal allergic rhinitis and stuff like that. It's cheap. It's over-the-counter. It's just a 600-milligram pill once a day. But it seems to help modulate a lot of this cytokine immune response in the treatment of COVID.
Okay. And the last one that I guess there would be a little controversy over is CBD. Tell me about that.
So CBD is really controversial because whether it has THC in it or not, things like that. But I don't think there are many physicians left out there that can dispute the very powerful anti-inflammatory properties of CBD. We've used it in the treatment of arthritis quite effectively, especially along with turmeric. So the CBD that I use, that I get from the pharmacy that I have, does have some curcumin in it or turmeric. So I haven't given that one. But the articles about CBD and COVID are just now coming out. And there's been a couple of studies that have come out recently. Dr. Risch has actually sent me a few. And these studies basically allude to up to a threefold reduction in mortality and hospitalization rate if the patients are being treated with CBD.
Okay.
So that makes it a pretty significant thing if you can take CBD and increase your likelihood of staying out of the hospital threefold.
Right. Okay, so that's your treatment plan, and for the patients in states where they can't get your treatment plan and everything, if they want to drive to Texas, that's a possibility. But
so in states where they can't get my treatment plan, they can at least do the vitamin regimen, and that's better than just taking Tylenol and sitting at home.
Right, right. Okay, so now I think we've covered most of the stuff that that I wanted to ask you about. I think you said if all primary care physicians would use this regimen early on, the brunt of this pandemic could be cleared in a few weeks.
Yes, sir, that's correct.
So, Dr. Fauci and his boys and the national media don't have a plan. They're not able to handle this epidemic. But if they did it the way that you do it, we might be out of this in 3 weeks. So I'm wondering if people who are listening today should not put as much pressure as they can on their senators, on House members, on governors, on whoever.
On their own doctors, too.
Their own doctors, yes, and everything, and not let up until this happens, because we don't need this in the background, and it's ruining our economy, and it's killing people every day. So that's the message that I wanted to bring through you to the public with this podcast.
Sure. Well, it's been my pleasure, and I agree with all of that wholeheartedly.
Just one thought. Why do you think is all the pushback against this drug?
I think that the mass disinformation campaign against hydroxychloroquine has several facets to it. I think mainly it is an attempt by the left and the fake news media to subvert the will of the president, to sabotage our economy, to kill as many people as possible, and to cause as much chaos as possible to make our president look like a failure so that he loses the election.
So you think the basic thing we're talking about is political? But
I think that it's purely political. I think there's two facets to it. I think part of it's political, and the rest of it always comes back to money.
Well, that's so what I was going to say.
People are getting rich off of this somewhere, and if they make the vaccine and they mandate that on everybody, then companies like Moderna and Pfizer and are standing to profit a lot from this. And probably people like Fauci, who has been profiting off of Big Pharma his entire career.
Well, Brian, it's been really great to be able to talk to you about this problem. You're obviously well-educated. You have a proven success record with early aggressive treatment of COVID. And I hope that everybody that hears this podcast will send it out to 5 other people at least. Because if we can get the message out, we'll be able to do something about it. If we're afraid and hiding, like so many of Americans are, we'll continue to die.
I agree. Well, thanks for having me, Wynn. I appreciate it. And I hope America wakes up pretty soon, because we're running out of time.
Well,